Hi, this is Joseph Homburg. It's November 14th, 2007. We're in Studio X in Urbana, Illinois. My name is Brent Cochran, and the videographer is Henry Ratcliffe. Okay. Mr. Homburg, what's your date of birth?
May 25th, 1914.
And you joined the Army. Were you drafted, or did you enlist?
I was drafted,
yes. You were drafted. How did you feel about being drafted?
Well, I didn't object. I wasn't one of these conscientious objectors or anything like that. I was ready to go. The only thing that bothered me was that my wife was 5 months pregnant, and I would have loved to have been present at his birth, which I wasn't able to, and I asked for a deferment of several months, and I was denied, so I accepted that, and I went into the Army in May of 1943.
How did your wife handle that? How did she feel about you being drafted?
Well, she wasn't very happy, but she accepted it, and she knew that there were millions of other men, a lot of them under the same circumstances as I was, that went into the service, and she accepted it and made the best of it.
Where did you live at the time that you were drafted?
I lived in Champaign, Illinois.
Champaign?
Yeah.
Did you have the opportunity to choose which service you were going into, or did they just tell you you were going
into? No, I didn't have that. I didn't volunteer for a particular service, so I had to go wherever they decided. It was at their discretion. And I didn't really know when I was after my induction into the Army at Camp Grant, we were put on a train, the destination of which we didn't know, and we didn't know. We traveled and traveled all day through the night until the following morning, and we were in Texas, and we were greeted at the station by some officers, and I immediately saw the insignia on their collars, and when I saw the crossed rifles, I knew I was in the infantry.
How did you feel about that?
Well, I was a little surprised, but I accepted it. You know, after all, the infantry is the queen of battles, It's an honor to be a part of the infantry because they did a lot of very important work. At any rate, I was sent to Camp Walters, Texas, just a short distance from Fort Worth. It was the largest infantry replacement training center, IRTC, in the country. I didn't know that at the time, but I found out later. It was divided into different battalions, and I knew it wasn't going to be easy, but I accepted it, and you're given a series of tests, and to see what qualifications you had, and they wanted to know what your IQ was, and they wanted to know some of the other qualifications you might have that you weren't even aware of. And it so happened that one of the tests was listening to a series of sounds followed by a series of other sounds, and you were supposed to designate if the second sound was the same or if it was different. I had no idea what that was for or what it meant, but I was told later on that I scored very high in that, and I was being infantry trained as a rifleman, but my specialty would be radio operator, because they immediately said, "Are you a ham radio operator because you did so well on the test?" I said, "No." And I was pleased because I thought that would be kind of nice, and it turned out to be nice. So along with my basic training as a rifleman, along with all the other infantry riflemen, I also was trained as a radio operator, learning the Morse code and so forth. And they have a special way of teaching. You know, they say there's the right way and the Army way. I'm sure you heard that expression. But I want to tell you, the Army method of teaching I thought was excellent. For example, I never fired a weapon in my life. And when we were given our rifles for the first time and were trained how to use them, were trained about the nomenclature, how to disassemble it and to assemble it. And their method of teaching was so good that I think any person, even with a low IQ, would have no trouble learning how to handle a rifle. And we got so efficient with that that we took great pride in seeing if we could disassemble it and reassemble it in the dark. And we would do that on our bunks at night, turn the lights out, take the rifle apart, and by touch, you can tell what each, and we had to learn the nomenclature, we could tell by the touch what each piece was and how it was to be assembled into your weapon. And it was miraculous to me. And when it came time to go to the firing range, I had never shot a weapon before in my life. First time I made marksman, and several weeks later, we went to the range for a second time, and I made sharpshooter, and I was pretty proud of that. Fortunately, I never had to fire my weapon during my combat experience, and I'm very happy about that.
How old were you at the time that you went to basic training?
I was 29.
How did that affect your basic training experience? Did that
How
did that affect your basic training experience? Were you treated the same? Were you just another guy?
I was treated the same. I was in a training company with mostly young men. I would say 18, 19, 20. And the training was pretty rigorous. And I never fell out of a hike. And some of those hikes, marching, were pretty tough, going uphill particularly. And never had any trouble going through the infiltration course and so forth, where you had to protect your weapon and crawl on the hot sand, and the sand can get very hot in Texas in the summertime, and crawl under barbed wire, and a live machine gun was firing overhead, and you had to keep your body pretty flat to the ground, so you were really close. And I went through that, and after that it was landing ship trainer exercise. I remember one incident when we had to go up a hill which was pretty steep in full field pack, helmet, rifle, and all of a sudden somebody yells out, "Gas," and immediately you have to take your gas mask out and put it on and continue climbing that tremendously steep hill. Well, when we got to the top of that hill, everyone was exhausted, just exhausted. We were given a few moments to rest, which we did. When I got, it was a landing ship trainer after that, and we went through that. That wasn't so bad. It was climbing up a rope ladder from a little boat onto a mock ship. But when I got back to the barracks, it was lunchtime, and I didn't eat lunch that day. I just had something very, very light. But I earned the respect of all these youngsters who, a lot of them were college graduates or the students that were in the ASTP. That was a program for students. We had that here at the University of Illinois. And they started to call me old man. But they respected me. I never once fell out of any forced march or any of the exercises that we had to perform. And basic training for an infantryman is pretty difficult.
Absolutely.
So I'm proud of that. And I think that takes care of that aspect.
Now, when you left Texas, did you go to England?
Pardon?
When you left Texas, where did you go?
I was lucky during my training. After the 13-week training cycle, then you're at the mercy of the Army. You don't know what's going to happen to you. But it just so happened that on the very last day of our basic training, it was a Saturday, and I usually went with a buddy of mine. We would go into town, have dinner, go to a movie, and so forth. I suddenly felt sick. I wasn't well. I wasn't myself. And I remember telling my friend, as we were walking to the bus, we were going right by the dispensary. That's where you go on sick call. I said, Harold, you know, I really feel pretty tough. I think I'm going to go in and see if they can help me. Well, I went in. And the nurse gave me a cursory examination, put a thermometer in my mouth, and took my temperature. She said, soldier, I want you to go back to your barracks and get your toilet articles and so forth. You're going to the hospital. I said, what? She said, so they don't tell you what's wrong with you. So I was in the hospital. I found out after, again, they gave me a private room with a steamer, and so I guessed right away I had pneumonia. And I was in the hospital for about 3 weeks. At that time, they didn't have the technology or the drugs to knock pneumonia out very quickly. At any rate, while I was on my hospital bunk in the ward, our first sergeant and the platoon leader, who's a lieutenant, and the first sergeant, you know, is the fellow with all the stripes and the little diamond in the middle, came to see me. And I was kind of surprised. They said, Hamburg, we need your signature here. You were on orders to go to Fort Benning, Georgia for advanced infantry training. And you have to be deleted because you're sick. I was very happy about that because I knew of other GIs that after basic training, that if they were sent to Benning, that the next thing was overseas. And that was during the African campaign. And a friend of mine had that experience, and he wound up, I think he was killed on one of the beaches, Battle of Casino or something like that. So as a result of that, my training cycle was over, and there everyone wasn't shipped out. There were a number of them, and we really didn't have too much to do. We would play ball or just do a little marching drill just for the fun of it and so mm-hmm. forth. And one day the first sergeant said, "Hamburg, how would you like to go to cadre school?" I said, "What does that involve?" And he gave me an idea. I said, "I think that'd be a good idea." He said, "I do too." He said, "You get your stuff together and we'll..." It was a different part of the camp. It lasts 3 weeks, and you have training to become an NCO, a non-commissioned officer. So I really enjoyed that, and it was at a time of year when early autumn, and the weather was good, and when I was through after the 3 weeks, I came back, and shortly after that, I was promoted to PFC. That's a big thing, you know, when you're just a lowly private and you get the PFC stripe, you take a lot of razzing, but everyone is envious. And the sergeant, when he gave it to me, said, "Hamburg, I want you to be sure and have those stripes sewn on. I want you to wear them. I don't want you to put them away." He said, "You're a PFC now, and you be proud of it," which I did. And still continued. I was assigned, as a result of that, I was assigned to the cadre, which I was happy about. And I taught radio code, taught the trainees radio code. And after a short time, the first sergeant called me into the orderly room and said, "Hamburg, you've just been promoted to corporal." I was proud of that. I had my stripes sewn on. And I was there for almost a whole year. As a member of the cadre, teaching and so forth. And then I received orders that I was being shipped to the East Coast, to a port of embarkation. And I knew that was in preparation to going overseas. In the meantime, I left out a very important part of my life. While we were on a field problem during my basic training, we were way out in the wilderness someplace, and there's a lot of areas where it's wilderness in Texas. And we were bivouacked because it was a training program of different, it took several days. We pitched our shelter halves and had which resulted in a pup tent and two men to a pup tent. One night, I had just fallen asleep and it was around close to midnight. I see headlights shining right into the opening of the pup tent, and I hear a voice says, "Hamburg." And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Front and center." And I came out and he said, I knew my wife was just about ready for delivery. So he said, "Hamburger, proud father of a bouncing baby boy." I said, "Wonderful." He said, "We're going to allow you to go into camp, get your uniform on, and we'll take you in the Jeep, and you can make a telephone call," which I did. By that time, it was 2 o'clock in the morning. I called my mother-in-law, and she gave me all the particulars, and I was extremely happy. My wife was all right. My mother-in-law, I said, who does he look like? She said, oh, he's beautiful. He's just beautiful. I didn't get to see him until he was 4.5 months old when I got my first furlough. He was born in the middle of September, and I got my furlough in January. And it was wonderful to be home again, even for a short time, and to become acquainted with my new son. He was just 4.5 months old. And then I was lucky, after I got my orders to go to the port of embarkation, I was lucky to get another furlough. It was delay en route. They gave you time between the time you left camp to go to your destination. I got a 10-day leave, for which I was very happy. I got to spend that at home, and Stephen had already, he was about 6 months old then. And from then on, it was a series of going through several camps and then over to England for more training, and finally over to France, and that's another story.
How did that feel when you found out that you were finally going to France?
How did I feel?
When you left England to head to France, how was that experience?
Well, when I left England to go to France that first time, I knew that we were going to the battlefield. I knew that right away. We were put on ships, and then when we got off the ships, we were on these landing crafts. And when we got to shore, you know, the ships aren't allowed to go too close to the shore because of being grounded. So we're out some distance, and then the landing craft takes you to the shore. But this was, I landed at Utah Beach, July 14th, 1944, and of course, nobody was firing at us. The beaches had been secured, and the Allied forces had been able to penetrate. The whole front from east to west was approximately 50 miles, and the area that they occupied was about 15 to 20 miles deep. So there really wasn't a lot of real estate that the Allied forces owned.
Could you hear the combat going on in the distance, or were you how aware of what was going on?
Once in a while, you could hear a few little rumbles. We were right near a little town named Isigny, Isigny. And I could never tell how big that town was, nor were we allowed to go in town to visit with the natives. But I do know that we were bivouacked in an area just right outside of a little park that reminded me a lot of the West Side Park here in Champaign. And Normandy is known for its dairy products, and there were a lot of dairy products. And I'm alluding to the fact that Isigny really didn't mean very much to me. I did know that we were about 15 miles from St. Lô. That was a pivotal city in Normandy. That was the reason that the progress of the Allied troops was being hampered. We really couldn't move. They just went 15, 20 miles. And being a pivotal city with control of the roads and so forth, we couldn't move very easily.
How secure did you feel when you were there? Did you feel like you were in a combat zone, or did you feel like it was a garrison?
This actually, this was in the rear of the combat zone. Mm-hmm. We were maybe 15 or 20 miles away from the real action. And we went over as free replacements, infantry trained, each with his particular specialty if he had one. And we're just waiting to be assigned. We had no idea where we were going. And we had no duties to perform, so we would just maybe play a little ball. One of the very wonderful things was the daily newspaper that the armed services printed called the Stars and Stripes. Well, you were in the service, weren't you?
Yes,
are you familiar with that?
Yes.
Well, when we got that paper, we devoured it from cover to cover because that told us the progress of the war and what was going on. And we were just waiting to be assigned. I landed there on this July 14th, but I really wasn't assigned to a division until the first week of August. So it was period of a couple of weeks.
During that time, were you feeling really ready to go, or were you happy that you were
Well, I was preparing myself for any eventuality. I was just hoping that I would be with a good outfit, or your buddies would be friendly, and I was hoping that I would be assigned as I knew I'd be assigned as an infantryman, but as a radio operator. And luckily I was assigned to the 2nd Infantry Division, 9th Infantry Regiment, 3rd Battalion Headquarters. And I got to know the fellas, and they were all really nice guys, and said, "We'll take care of you, Hamburg, and teach you the ropes and all that." And I felt secure because for such a long time I was attached and unassigned, and now I found a home. When I reported to the company commander, who was a captain, I reported, and he said, "Well, I see, Hamburg, I see you're a corporal." He said, "Our table of orders doesn't call for an NCO with your grade." I said, and by that time I had gotten to know the fellas, I said, "Captain, you can bust me, but I want to stay here." And he said, "Well, don't worry about that." And I did get to stay as a radio operator. And
so you felt very happy in your new unit?
Pardon?
You felt very comfortable in your new unit?
Yes, I did. I knew the dangers that existed, these other men in the outfit were pretty well seasoned by that time, and they had been in right from the very beginning, and they would tell you things and help you along, and so you really began to feel very comfortable.
When did your unit first move more towards the front lines? When did you first head towards the front lines?
That very evening that I was assigned. That evening, fella in the communications section, I think he was a wireman, that's the telephone, and I was the radio operator, and they handed me an SCR 300, which was a fairly heavy radio, which I had a sling over my back, and I carried my weapon, and he said, "Hamburg, we have to go to the command post." And it was dark, and he said, "I know where it is." He said, "Just walk along with me, and if any flares are shot up by the Germans, Just stand still and be absolutely motionless, because you have no idea how bright those flares are. And one did go up shortly after we started out, and it just lit up the whole countryside. And we stopped, and finally it lost its full power as it was coming down to Earth, and we were able to proceed, and we finally got to our, it was a little farmhouse, and when we entered, there was a black cloth hanging in the doorway, hiding the light, because if you expose too much light, you're a target. So I was, they had sort of a little excavation, something like a cellar, and I went down there and put the earphones on, and I didn't have to do anything. I just listened, and I just heard a lot of activity going on that was all radio signals, which I couldn't understand because they were so fast and so many. I had no idea, but I was told of just to listen, monitor, so forth. And that was my first experience in combat.
To go back to when the flare was shot, how did you feel as you were standing there waiting for the light to go out?
Well, I felt exposed. You'd be surprised how bright that was. I just felt exposed. Anyway, when it finally subsided and we were able to go forward, I felt better. On the way to that farmhouse, I encountered my first dead GI, which was a bad experience. But you learn to harden yourself and accept it. And I want to mention one thing about Isigny, that town. Just a little sidelight experience. 40 years later, when I took my wife, we were on a little trip to Europe, and went on a sightseeing. We were on the sightseeing bus, and we visited the invasion area, and we were on this four-lane, beautiful highway. And I was looking out the window, and all of a sudden I see a good-sized sign that said, Isigny, Isigny, yogurt capital of the world. I said, Merle, take a look. This is where I landed. This is where Utah Beach was. And I got real excited. And we didn't have time to go into the town. I would like to have seen what it was like.
Do you remember the first time you saw a German soldier?
The first German soldier I saw was a prisoner of war. And I was very happy about that. They're human beings, and I remember one of them was sort of a wise guy, and he was cursing and spewing out a lot of venomous rhetoric about General Eisenhower. He said, that guy's causing us all kinds of trouble. He could speak a little English, he had that thick German accent. But after that, I saw a lot of German prisoners. And what a delightful feeling you have when you see them marching.
Having seen them as prisoners, did that change the way you looked at them as combatants?
I didn't hear your question.
After seeing them up close as prisoners like that and seeing them as people, how did that make you feel about them when it was in conflict, when it was in a combat situation?
They're humans, and they have feelings, and they're at the mercy of their government, of the leaders, and they're forced to do what they have to do. that doesn't mean that that they were sympathetic to the Nazi cause, for example. So I really didn't have any ill feeling towards them. And I remember when I was on the hospital ship going from Normandy back to England, the prisoners of war who were wounded were right alongside all of the GIs, and they were given the same treatment. They were given the very same medical treatment, and I want to tell you that the medical department of the Army did a magnificent job. That's another story.
Was there any situation that you felt like you were directly being attacked by the enemy? Did you ever have a...
We were in Normandy, in action, actually, for several days. And then we were pulled out and put in reserve. And that means you don't see any action. And during that time, the USO and the Special Services Department were very, very good about sending entertainers. And right up at the front, Dinah Shore, she made an appearance, and they built the stage, and she got up there and was doing her act and singing. And I remember all of the GIs, we didn't have chairs, we turned our helmets over and sat on the dome of our helmets with our rifles alongside us. And I thought that was great. That's the only entertainer that I really got to see. Anyway, after a short time in Normandy, we were told that we were going to another destination, and we were put on transport trucks, and it was the 2nd Infantry Division, the 29th Infantry Division, who fought alongside the 2nd during a good part of the war, and a battalion of Rangers. We were ordered to go to the port city of Brest, France, and to capture the city, which was being held by an elite paratroop division that were not used to being defeated. They were a crack outfit. And it was there. It was the latter part of August by the time we traveled all night and finally got there early the following morning. And we didn't go into the attack mode until later on. And the German forces occupied the city, which they had the high ground. They actually were looking down our throats, and when we attacked, we were at a terrible disadvantage. But at any rate, on the 29th of August, I was digging a foxhole with my buddy. You know, everything in the Army is buddy system. And fortunately, the hedgerows offered a wonderful shelter from enemy fire. And they varied in size. I remember we were dug in behind hedgerows that were maybe 2 feet high. Sometimes they were 3 or 4 feet high. This particular hedgerow was the largest I had ever seen. It was about 10 feet high and about 5 feet thick. So that was pretty good cover. So my buddy and I were digging our foxholes, and then the Germans started to shell. And they had 88 millimeter cannons mounted on tanks. which was one of the best weapons in the German army. And it fired a shell about this long and about this big around, had a muzzle velocity of 3,000 feet a second. Now, an M1 rifle takes a 30 caliber bullet, which is about this long and maybe about as big as a little finger. It has a muzzle velocity of 2,900 feet a second. So you can imagine when a shell like that, it is so fast, when you hear the muzzle blast, less than a second later, the shell is there and it has exploded. So what you hear is a boom, boom. The second boom is the explosion. And they started to shell us. And fortunately, I was behind a hedgerow and a hit on the other side of the hedgerow. And suddenly, my left arm went numb. And I thought it was from the concussion. And involuntarily, I started to shake my arm, hoping that the feeling would come back. And then my buddy who was digging with me said, "Hey, Hamburger, you're hit." I looked down and he said, "You got a hole here and a hole here." And that was the extent of I didn't know how serious it was, but I found out later after surgery that they had the bullet or the shrapnel had broken the ulna bone, compound comminuted fracture, injured the median nerve, and my arm was in a cast from here to here with a diagram showing me which the doctors, anyone that wanted to know what was wrong could see what it was. And
When you found out, when you realized you were wounded, did you feel scared or relieved? Or
I was terribly surprised. I can't describe my emotion. I wasn't relieved. I was worried, what's going to happen to me? And right away, after when the shelling stopped, the first sergeant always goes around and he hollers out, "Anybody hit? Anybody hit?" And my buddy said, "Yes, Sergeant Hamburger's hit here. He's Hamburg, go back to the aid station." And I started back. I didn't know where the aid station was. I had to ask one of the GIs on the way, and he gave me some directions, and finally I got there. And
but before that point, had you had any friends wounded at all?
What?
Were any of your friends ever wounded before you were? Did you experience anyone?
No. I was the only one in that particular outfit, in that section, in the communications section, that was hit. Now, what happened subsequent to that, I have no knowledge, but I, and along with me being wounded was our our leader, who was a first lieutenant. He was struck in the neck, and I remember sitting in the ambulance with him. My first concern was, "Lieutenant, do you think I'll be able to come back with the outfit after I get out of the hospital?" I had no idea the extent of my injury. He said, "Oh, sure." I never saw him after that, nor did I ever get back to my outfit.
What was your experience in the hospitals and the aid stations?
I have nothing but the highest respect for the medics, the whole medical department of the Army, all the way from the MASH unit that I went to. That was this was before the MASH movies, so you had no idea what it was like. But after seeing the movie, it was very similar to that. Every tent city, everything in tents. I was put on a gurney, and I had to wait all night in terrible pain before I was taken to surgery, because they had so many wounded men. And I remember the treatment that we got, the efficiency and the attention and the speed with which they did things was really heartwarming and astounding. I remember when I was finally taken into the operating room, also, everything was tense. And I was still in my uniform with my boots and everything, leggings. And immediately the nurse on one side, she took scissors and cut my sleeve off and lathered my arm and started to shave it. And a doctor on the other side had done the same thing with this arm, cut the sleeve off and so forth. And he had a needle in his hand, and he swabbed the inside of my arm like this, and he said, "Make a fist," which I did. I said, "What's that needle for?" He said, "Oh, this is the anesthetic." I said, "Anesthetic?" I looked and I said, "You got to be kidding." He said, "Oh, you think so? Count to 10. I remember, as he stuck the needle in, I remember saying, "What?" I didn't even get to finish saying the number one. And I was out like a light. That was sodium pentothal, and that was an anesthetic of shorter duration. And after they put you to sleep, then they give you the heavier dosage of anesthetic. So the next thing I knew, I woke up. It was 9 o'clock in the morning. Sun was shining. Birds were singing. I was on a canvas cot. First thing I did is look to see if my arm was still there. It was in this cast that I mentioned, with the diagram of what happened. And a ward boy came along. I don't think he was more than 17 or 18 years old. And I was wondering what this young kid was doing in the Army. And he was a medic. He was like a nurse taking care of patients. And when he saw that I had awakened, he came over and said, "How you doing, soldier?" I said, "Okay, I'm in some pain," which I was for a long time. And I said, "I'm hungry." He said, "Well, we'll bring you some breakfast," which he eventually did. And he ran his hands over my face, which was, I had a pretty good growth of beard. And he said, "You need a shave, soldier." And he said, "I'll fix you up." And he did. He came back later and shaved me and brought me breakfast. And from there on in, it was getting ready to be shipped back to a hospital in England. Shall I continue and go a little further? Do you have any questions?
Absolutely.
Well, I could go on and on and on.
When you were in England, what was the experience like that in the hospital? Did you have any contact with your family at that time? Or
I was able to write letters. That's the only contact I had. I was sent to a general hospital, which is the elite. That's where they have all the facilities that you need in any first-class hospital. And I was there for about 3 months. They performed about three more surgeries on my arm and went through a period of therapy, physical therapy. When they removed the cast, my arm was about this big around. But they said, don't worry, it'll get back to normal size. And I have the highest respect for the medical department in the Army. They did a magnificent job. And after my stay in the hospital, incidentally, several days after I got to the hospital, the executive officer who was a major in full uniform came to our ward and called out the names of four people, of which mine was one of them, and said, "Gentlemen, I'm happy to award you with your Purple Heart." So we all stood there, and of course this arm was in a cast, and he handed me my Purple Heart, which I took in this hand. Then he stood back. I couldn't return the salute. But he understood anyway. After that, it was a series of rehabilitation centers and interviews and so forth and so on until I finally wound up with a replacement depot in Verviers, Belgium, who just right about the time when the Battle of the Bulge took place, and we were processing troops going to the front, and I had a job in their classification section, which I was happy about, and we just processed troops going through, and finally in May the 8th of that year, the war ended, and it was a process of going home through the point system. You were awarded points, and if you reached a certain level of points, you got to go home. And my last place of assignment was in Reims, France, at the Champagne capital of the world, at the Little Red Schoolhouse where the peace treaty was signed. And that was quite an experience for me.
So were you there when the peace treaty was signed?
No, it was after.
That was afterwards.
I got there, I think it was in maybe September. And I wasn't there very long. From there on in, when the level of points you needed became 84, I remember I had 84 points, then I was on my way home. So I was relieved of duty there and sent to another headquarters, and finally down to Marseille, France, and shipped out and got home. And separated from the Army at Camp Grant, again, in Illinois, where I was mustered into the Army, and got to come home and to see my young son again, who was, at that time, 2.5 years old.
And that was the first time you'd seen him?
That was a real happy reunion. That's the first time I had seen him in a year and a half.
Do you remember what you did your first few weeks home? How you spent that time?
Well, visited with family and visited with friends and made preparations to leave the community. We moved to Minneapolis, where my in-laws were from, and a whole series of things. And eventually we came back back to Champaign, and we've been here ever since.
What was life like when it returned back to normal for you? Did it, when it returned, when life returned to normal, when you got back into a normal
working
day? More
or less,
yes.
There were an awful lot of servicemen that had come back, and a lot of them just took up their lives where they had left them and just continued on, those that were lucky enough to come back. I, in answering your questions, I forgot that I wanted to read this particular thing that I prepared to give people some insight. This is all related to D-Day and everything that led up to it and the importance of anyway, this is what I wrote. It'll just take a couple of minutes. It is important, first of all, to recall and to talk about all the preparations and planning that took place prior to the actual invasion by the supreme commanders of this massive invasion army. This fighting force was comprised of 3 United States divisions, 2 British divisions, and 1 Canadian division. It was agreed that the United States General Dwight D. Eisenhower would be the supreme commander of the entire Allied invasion army, consisting of 1,500,000 soldiers, 5,300 ships and boats of all description, plus 2,500 landing craft. In the early morning of June 6, 1944, more than 4,000 ships carried 150,000 American, British, Canadian, and Polish troops across the English Channel to France. In the air, 11,000 fighter planes, bombers, and transports provided support. By the end of the day, 15,000 Allied soldiers would be dead or wounded. This represented the largest amphibious landing in world history, and it was indeed the beginning of the Allied liberation of Europe. The American forces stormed the Normandy coast at Omaha Beach and Utah Beach, the names of which I believe are familiar to all Americans, and the British armies assaulted Gold, Sword, and Sword Beaches, and the Canadian forces landed on Juneau Beach. These were all code names of the different areas of invasion. I would like to point out that D-Day took place 63 years ago. A period representing 3 full generations of people. And I am estimating that a good many of them weren't even born or were too young to recall this historic event. And I know it must be difficult for them to grasp the magnitude of this military action. At any rate, the invasion proved to be successful, and by the end of the day, all 5 beachheads were secured, and by the evening, the enemy was driven back away from the Normandy coast. And from that point in, I related my involvement in the war.
That's beautiful. Do you have anything else you'd like to say about your experience or any stories in specific?
I can't say enough about the medics. They were really wonderful. Just happy to be here.
Thank you very much. Great job. I guess that'll be all then?
Yes.
Is that all?
That's it.
They can do with the camera.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it gets, he do other things with it once I edit it.